For as has been said, every human soul has by its nature beheld the things that are, or it would never have come into this living creature. But it is not easy for every soul to recall those things from what it perceives here, not for those that had only a brief glimpse then, nor for those that, once fallen here, had the misfortune of being turned toward wrongdoing through certain associations, so that they hold unto forgetfulness of the sacred things they saw then. Few are left in whom memory is present in sufficient strength, and these, whenever they see some likeness of the things above, are struck with amazement and no longer master of themselves, though they do not understand what is happening to them, because they cannot perceive it clearly enough. Now in the likenesses found here there is no brightness at all of justice or self-control or the other things honored by souls. Instead, through dim instruments and with difficulty, only a few, approaching the images, make out the true nature of what is imaged. But beauty was radiant to see back then, when we, following in the blessed company, we with Zeus, others with some other god, beheld the blessed vision and sight, and were initiated into that rite which is right to call the most blessed of all, which we celebrated while whole ourselves and untouched by the evils awaiting us in time to come, gazing in pure light upon whole, simple, unshakable, and blissful visions, being ourselves pure and unmarked by this thing we now carry around and call a body, shackled to it the way an oyster is shackled to its shell. Let this much be granted to memory, for whose sake, out of longing for those things, I have now spoken at some length. But concerning beauty, as we said, it shone among those things there, and coming here we have grasped it shining most clearly through the clearest of our senses. For sight is the sharpest of the perceptions that come to us through the body, though wisdom is not seen by it, for it would arouse terrible longings if it presented so clear an image of itself to sight, nor is any other of the lovable things seen by it. But beauty alone has been granted this fate, to be the most visible and the most lovely. Now the man who is not newly initiated, or who has become corrupted, does not move quickly from here to there, toward beauty itself, when he looks at what bears its name here. So he feels no reverence as he gazes at it, but gives himself over to pleasure and tries, animal-like, to mount and beget offspring. And consorting with wanton excess, he feels no fear or shame in pursuing pleasure against nature. But the one freshly initiated, who saw much back then, when he sees a godlike face that reflects beauty well, or some form of body, first shudders, and something of the old fear comes over him. Then, gazing at it, he reveres it as a god, and if he were not afraid of seeming utterly mad, he would sacrifice to his beloved as to a sacred image and a god. And once he has seen him, as if from the shuddering there comes a change, and sweat and an unfamiliar heat take hold of him. For having received through his eyes the emanation of beauty, he grew warm, and by this the wing's nature is watered. And once warmed, the parts around the growth of the wing, which for a long time had been closed up by hardness and prevented from sprouting, begin to melt, and as nourishment flows in, the stalk of the wing swells and rushes to grow from the root beneath the whole form of the soul, for the whole soul was once winged. In this state, then, the whole soul seethes and throbs, and just as children cutting teeth feel an itching and irritation around the gums when the teeth are just coming in, so the soul of one beginning to grow wings suffers the same thing, it seethes, and is irritated and tickled as it grows its feathers. So when it gazes at the beauty of the boy and receives particles flowing to it from there, for this reason they are called longing, it is watered and warmed by this longing, and its pain eases and it rejoices. But when it is apart from him and grows parched, the mouths of the passages through which the wing pushes close up as they dry, shutting in the sprouting of the wing, and this, locked inside together with the longing throbbing like a pulse, presses against its own outlet, so that the whole soul, stung all around, is maddened with pain, yet holding the memory of beauty, it rejoices. And from the mixture of these two, it is thrown into distress by the strangeness of its condition, and being at a loss it rages, and in its madness it can neither sleep at night nor stay still by day, but runs wherever it thinks it may see the one who holds its beauty. And once it sees him and lets the stream of longing pour in, it releases what had been blocked up, and getting relief from the stinging and the pangs, it reaps, for the moment, this sweetest of pleasures. For this reason it is not willingly left behind, and it values no one more than the beautiful one, but forgets mothers and brothers and all its companions, and thinks nothing of losing its property through neglect, and despising all the customs and proprieties in which it once took pride. It is ready to be a slave and to sleep wherever it is allowed, as near as possible to the object of its longing. For besides revering the one who possesses the beauty, it has found in him the only healer of its greatest sufferings. This condition, fair boy, to whom my speech is addressed, men call love, but if you hear what the gods call it, you will likely laugh because of your youth. Some of the descendants of Homer, I believe, quote two lines about love from the Hidden Verses, one of which is quite outrageous and not very well metered. They sing them like this: "Him mortals call the winged one, love, but the immortals call him feather grower, because of the necessity to grow feathers." One may believe this or not, but the cause and the experience of lovers is, at any rate, just what has been described. Now of those who follow Zeus, the one who is caught bears the burden of the name of wings more steadily. But those who served Ares and moved about in his train, when they are captured by love and think themselves wronged in some way by their beloved, become murderous and ready to sacrifice both themselves and the boy. And so it goes for each, according to the god whose chorus he belonged to. He lives, so far as he can, honoring and imitating that god, as long as he remains uncorrupted and is living out his first life here, and in this manner he behaves and deals with both his beloveds and everyone else. So each person chooses his love among the beautiful according to his own character, and treating that one as though he were the god himself, fashions and adorns him for himself like a sacred image, meaning to honor and celebrate him. Those who belong to Zeus, then, seek a soul that is like Zeus in the one they love. So they look to see whether he is naturally philosophical and fit to lead, and when they find such a one and fall in love with him, they do everything they can to make him become so. So if such people haven't already been set on this course before, they take it up now, learning wherever they can and pursuing it on their own, and by tracking the nature of their own god within themselves they succeed, because they've been forced to keep their gaze fixed intently on the god, and by holding fast to him in memory, possessed as they are, they take on his habits and practices, so far as it's possible for a human being to share in a god. They credit their beloved for this and love him all the more, and if they draw, as the Bacchic women do, from Zeus, then it is on the soul of their beloved that they pour it, making him as much like their own god as they can. Those who followed in Hera's train look for someone kingly, and once they find him, do all the same things for him. And so with the followers of Apollo, and of each god in turn. Going along the path of their own god, they look for a boy who is by nature suited to be his own, and once they've gotten hold of him, they imitate the god themselves, and they persuade and train their beloved, drawing him as far as each of them can toward that god's practice and character, not out of jealousy or mean-spirited ill will toward the boy, but trying with everything they have to bring him into the fullest possible likeness to themselves and to the god they honor. Such is the eagerness and such the right of those who truly love, if they manage to bring off what they're eager for in the way I've described. It becomes something beautiful and blessed, coming from the friend who has gone mad through love to the boy he loves, if that boy is won over. And a boy is won over in something like the following way. Just as at the start of this story, we divided each soul into two forms shaped like horses, and a third the form of a charioteer, let that stand for us still. Now of the horses, we say, one is good and the other is not. But we didn't spell out what the goodness of the good one is, or the badness of the bad one, and that must be said now. The one standing on the finer side is upright and clean-limbed, high-necked, somewhat hook-nosed, white to look at, black-eyed, a lover of honor joined with restraint and a sense of shame, a companion of true opinion, needing no whip, guided by command and reason alone. The other is crooked, a great hulking thing put together any old way, thick-necked, short-necked, snub-faced, black-skinned, gray-eyed, bloodshot, a companion of wanton violence and boastfulness, shaggy around the ears, deaf, barely yielding even to whip and spur. Now when the charioteer looks at the face that kindles desire, and warms his whole soul through with the sensation, and is filled with the tingling and the goading of longing, the horse that is obedient to the charioteer, constrained then as always by a sense of shame, holds himself back from lunging at the boy. But the other one no longer minds the charioteer's goad or whip at all. He bolts and plunges forward, and by giving every kind of trouble to his yoke mate and to the charioteer, he forces them to go toward the boy and to bring up the delights of sex. At first the other two resist and balk, indignant at being forced into something so terrible and lawless. But in the end, when there's no limit to the trouble, they go along, led on, giving in and agreeing to do what they're told. And so they come close to him, and see the beloved's face flashing before them. When the charioteer sees it, his memory is carried back to the true nature of beauty, and he sees it again standing together with restraint on its holy pedestal. And at the sight he is struck with fear and falls back in reverence, and at the same moment he's forced to haul back so hard on the reins that he throws both horses onto their haunches, the one willingly, since he wasn't resisting, but the violent one very much against his will. And once they've drawn back a little further, the one horse drenches his whole soul in sweat from shame and astonishment, while the other, once the pain has eased that he got from the bit and the fall, catches his breath with difficulty, and then bursts out in anger, cursing the charioteer and his yoke-mate at length as cowards and weaklings who deserted their post and broke their word, and forcing them again, though they're unwilling to come near. He only grudgingly gives way when they beg him to put it off to another time. When the agreed time comes and they pretend to have forgotten, he reminds them, forcing them, neighing, dragging them, and makes them come near the boy again with the same proposal. And once they're close, he lowers his head, stretches out his tail, takes the bit between his teeth, and hauls shamelessly. But the charioteer, gripped by the very same feeling now even more strongly, as though thrown back from a starting gate, hauls back the bit even more violently from between the teeth of the violent horse, bloodying his slandering tongue and his jaws, and forcing his legs and haunches down to the ground, delivers him over to pain. And when the wicked horse suffers the same thing again and again until he gives up his violence, he's humbled at last and follows the charioteer's guidance, and when he sees the beautiful boy, he's undone with fear. So that from then on it happens that the lover's soul follows the boy in reverence and awe. So then, since the boy is being courted with every kind of attention, as though he were the equal of a god, by someone who isn't just putting on a show of love but truly feels it, and since the boy himself is by nature disposed to be a friend to the one courting him, even if before this he had been talked against by companions or others who told him, it was shameful to keep close company with a lover, and because of that he had been pushing the lover away, as time goes on. His age and what has to happen bring him around to accepting the man's company. For it is never fated that bad should be friend to bad, nor that good should fail to be friend to good. And once he has accepted him, and taken in his conversation and company, the lover's goodwill, now felt at close range, strikes the beloved with wonder, as he comes to realize that all his other friends and relations together don't offer him any share of friendship to match this God-inspired friend. And when the lover keeps doing this over time and draws close to him, touching him in the wrestling grounds and in other kinds of company. Then at last the spring of that stream which Zeus, when he loved Ganymede, named Longing, flows in abundance toward the lover. And part of it sinks into him, and part, when he is filled to overflowing, flows back out. And just as a breath of air or an echo bounces back off something smooth and solid to the place it started from, so the stream of beauty travels back into the beautiful boy through his eyes, by the path nature has made for it to reach the soul. And arriving there and setting the boy's wings astir, it waters the passages of the feathers and starts them growing, and fills the beloved soul in turn with love. So he is in love, but with what, he's at a loss. He doesn't know what has happened to him and can't explain it. It's as if he had caught an eye infection from someone else, but he can't say what caused it. He doesn't realize that he's looking at himself, as in a mirror, in the person of his lover. And when the lover is present, his pain eases in exactly the same way as the lover's does. And when he's absent, in just the same way he longs and is longed for, holding an image of love, love in return, though he calls it and thinks it, not love but friendship. His desire is much like the lover's, though weaker, to see him, to touch him, to kiss him, to lie down beside him. And as one would expect, he soon does these things. So then in their lying together, the lover's unruly horse has plenty to say to the charioteer, and thinks he deserves some small enjoyment in return for all his trouble. But the beloved's horse has nothing to say, swollen with feeling and at a loss. He throws his arms around the lover and kisses him, welcoming him as someone truly good to him. And when they lie down together, he's the sort who wouldn't refuse to grant the lover his own share of the favor if he asked for it. But his yoke-mate, together with the charioteer, resists this with shame and reasoned argument. So if the better parts of their minds went out and lead them into an ordered way of life given over to philosophy, they pass their days here in blessing and harmony, masters of themselves and well-ordered, having enslaved the part that bred vice in the soul and set free the part that bred virtue. And when they die, having grown wings and become light, they have won one of the three truly Olympic contests, and neither human self-control nor divine madness can provide a person with any greater good than this. But if they instead take up a coarser way of life, without philosophy but caught up in love of honor, then perhaps sometime, in drink or through some other carelessness, their two unruly draft horses may catch their souls off guard, bring them together, and choose and carry out that course which is counted blessed by the many. And once they've done it, they go on doing it from then on, though rarely, since it isn't something their whole mind has approved. These two, then, are also friends, though less so than the others, both while their love lasts and after it's over, believing they've given and received from each other the greatest of pledges, which it would be wrong ever to break by falling into enmity. And at the end, though still wingless when they leave the body, they have set out on the path to growing wings, so that they carry off no small prize from their erotic madness. For it's not lawful for those who have already begun the journey beneath the sky to go down into darkness and the road under the earth, but rather, living a bright life, they journey on together in happiness, and when the time comes, for love's sake, become winged together. These gifts, so many and so godlike, my boy, will be given you by friendship with a lover, whereas closeness with one who does not love you, mixed as it is with mortal moderation, managing things in a mortal and tight-fisted way, breeding in the soul it loves the stinginess that the crowd praises as virtue, will leave that soul tumbling around the earth and beneath it mindless for 9,000 years. This, dear love, is the recantation I offer and pay back to you, as beautiful and as good as I could manage, forced in particular, among other things, to use somewhat poetic language for Phaedrus's sake. Forgive me for what I said before, and accept this with favor. Be kind and gracious, and don't take away or maim the art of love you gave me out of anger, but grant that I be honored even more than now among the beautiful. And if anything Phaedrus and I said earlier offended you, blame Lysias, the father of that speech, and make him stop such talk, and turn him toward philosophy, as his brother Polemarchus has turned, so that this lover of his may no longer waver both ways as he does now, but set his life simply toward love conducted with philosophical discourse.
I join you in that prayer, Socrates, if it's better for us that these things come about. But I've been marveling at your speech all this while, at how much finer a piece of work you've made it than the first one, so much so that I worry Lysias may come off looking poor, if he's even willing to set another speech up against it. In fact, my astonishing friend, someone among the politicians, was recently attacking him for this very thing, and all through his abuse, kept calling him a speechwriter. So perhaps out of sheer pride, he might just give up writing altogether.
That's a ridiculous notion you're voicing, young man, and you're quite wrong about your friend, if you really think he's that easily rattled. Perhaps you also think the man who was abusing him meant what he was saying.
That's how it looked, Socrates, and you yourself surely know that the most powerful and dignified men in our cities are ashamed to write speeches and leave writings of their own behind, for fear of the reputation it might earn them with posterity, being called sophists.
You've forgotten, Phaedrus, the sweet bend in the river. It got that name from the long bend in the Nile. And along with that bend, you've also forgotten that it's precisely the politicians who think the most of themselves who are most in love with writing speeches and leaving writings behind. So much so that, whenever they write a speech, they're so fond of their admirers that they add at the head of it, in each case, the names of whoever happens to be praising them.
What do you mean by that? I don't follow.
Don't you notice that, at the start of any piece written by a political man, the one who's praised is listed first?
How do you mean?
Something like, it seemed good to the council, or to the assembly, or to both, and so-and-so proposed it, the writer naming himself very solemnly and giving himself a compliment, and only then, after that, does he go on to display his own wisdom to his admirers, sometimes turning out quite a long piece of writing. Does that strike you as anything other than a speech that's been written down?
No, it doesn't strike me that way at all.
So then, if the measure holds up, the poet goes off from the theater delighted. But if it gets struck out and he ends up with no share in authorship, no standing as a writer worth reading, he's in mourning, and so are his friends.
Very much so.
Clearly not because they look down on the craft, but because they're in awe of it.
Certainly.
And what about this? When a speaker or a king becomes capable enough that, gaining the power of a Lycurgus or a Solon or a Darius, he becomes an immortal author in his city, doesn't he consider himself equal to a god, even while still alive? And don't those who come after him think the very same thing about him, gazing at what he's written?
Very much so.
Do you suppose, then, that any such man, however ill-disposed toward Lysias, would reproach him for the mere fact that he writes speeches?
That wouldn't be reasonable. Given what you're saying, he'd be reproaching his own ambition, it seems.
So this much, at least, is plain to everyone. Writing speeches is not itself shameful.
Of course not.
What's shameful, I think, is something else already, not speaking and writing well, but doing it shamefully and badly.
Clearly.
Then what is the manner of writing well as opposed to badly? Do we need, Phaedrus, to put Lysias to the test on this, and anyone else who has ever written or will write anything, whether a political piece or a private one, in verse as a poet or without verse as an ordinary person?
You ask whether we need to. What I ask you, would anyone live for, so to speak, if not for pleasures of just this sort? Certainly not for those pleasures that require pain beforehand or no pleasure at all, which is the case with nearly all the pleasures of the body, and that's exactly why they're rightly called slavish.
We have plenty of leisure, it seems, and at the same time, the cicadas up over our heads, singing away in this heat and talking to each other, seemed to me to be watching us too. If they saw the two of us, like most people at midday, not conversing but dozing, lulled by them out of laziness of mind, they'd have every right to laugh at us, thinking some slaves had come to their resting place and were sleeping around the spring at noon like sheep. But if they see us conversing, sailing right past them unenchanted like the sirens, they might just be pleased enough to grant us the gift they have to give humans from the gods.
And what gift is that? I confess, I've never heard of it.
It really doesn't suit a lover of the muses to be unacquainted with a thing like that. The story goes that these creatures were once human beings, from the time before the muses existed. When the muses came to be and song appeared, some of the people of that time were so overwhelmed with pleasure that, singing, they neglected food and drink and died without even noticing it. From them the race of cicadas was born afterward, having received this gift from the muses, that they need no nourishment once they come into being, but sing straight through, without food or drink, until they die, and after that go to the muses and report which of us here honors which of them. To Terpsichore they report those who have honored her in the dances and make them more beloved to her. To Erido, those honored in matters of love, and so on for each of the others, according to the kind of honor each receives. And to the eldest, Calliope, and to Urania next after her, they report those who spend their lives in philosophy and honor the music that belongs to those two. The muses who, more than any of the others, concern themselves with the heavens and with discourse, both divine and human, and who send forth the most beautiful voice of all. So for many reasons we ought to be talking rather than sleeping at midday.
Yes, we certainly ought to be talking.
Then let's look into what we set out just now to examine, in what way speaking and writing a speech is done well, and in what way it isn't.
Clearly.
Isn't it necessary, then, for anything that's going to be spoken well and rightly, that the mind of the speaker first know the truth about whatever he's going to speak about?
Here's what I've heard about that, my dear Socrates, that the man who's going to be a speaker doesn't need to learn what's truly just, only what will seem so to the crowd who'll be sitting in judgment, nor what's really good or fine, only what will seem so, since it's from these, not from truth, that persuasion comes.
Well, Phaedrus, a saying shouldn't just be tossed aside because wise men have said it. One should look to see whether there's something in it. And this one in particular shouldn't be let go without examination.
You're right.
Let's look at it this way, then.
Hold.
Suppose I tried to persuade you to acquire a horse to fend off enemies, and neither of us knew what a horse was, but I happen to know this much about you, that Phaedrus thinks a horse is whichever of the tame animals has the biggest ears.
That would be ridiculous, Socrates.
Not yet it wouldn't. But suppose I then tried in earnest to persuade you, composing a speech in praise of the donkey, calling it a horse, and saying that the beast is worth everything, worth keeping at home and taking on campaign, useful for fighting off the enemy, and able besides to carry your baggage and do plenty of other useful things.
Now that would be completely ridiculous.
Well, isn't it better to be a ridiculous friend than a clever and dangerous enemy?
It seems so.
So when the speechmaker, not knowing what's good and what's bad, takes hold of a city in the same condition and persuades it, not praising a donkey's shadow as if it were a horse, but praising something bad as if it were good, having studied the crowd's opinions and persuaded them to do bad things instead of good ones, what kind of harvest do you think rhetoric will reap afterward from the seeds it's sown?
Nothing very decent.
But then, my good man, haven't we been too rough on the art of speaking more than it deserves? It might well answer us. What on earth are you two talking nonsense about? I don't force anyone who's ignorant of the truth to learn to speak. Rather, if my advice is worth anything, one should acquire the truth first and only then take me up. What I claim and claim boldly is only this, that without me, the man who knows the facts will be no better able to persuade people through his craft.
Well, wouldn't she be right to say that?
I agree if the arguments that come at her bear witness that she really is a craft, but I seem to hear certain arguments approaching, testifying against her, saying that she's lying and that this isn't a craft at all, but a knack with no craft in it. As the Spartan says, there neither is nor ever will be a genuine craft of speaking that isn't grounded in truth.
We need those arguments, Socrates. Bring them here and put them to the test. See what exactly they say and how.
Come forward then, noble creatures, and persuade Phaedrus here, the father of beautiful children, that unless he philosophizes properly, he'll never be capable of speaking properly about anything either. Let Phaedrus answer.
Ask away.
Well then, isn't rhetoric, taken as a whole, a kind of leading of souls by means of words, not only in law courts and other public gatherings, but in private settings too, the same art applying to small matters as to great, and no more honorable when it's rightly used on serious matters than on trivial ones? Or is that not how you've heard it described?
No, by Zeus, not at all like that. It's mostly said and written as a craft in connection with lawsuits, and it's also said to apply to public speaking in the assembly. I haven't heard it extends further than that.
But surely you've heard of the arts of speaking that Nestor and Odysseus composed in their spare time at Troy. Have you really never heard of palames?
No, and by Zeus, I haven't even heard of Nestor's. Unless you're turning Gorgias into some kind of Nestor, or making Thrasymachus and Theodorus into an Odysseus.
Perhaps, but let's leave those men aside. Tell me instead, what do opposing parties in the courts do? Don't they argue against each other? Or what shall we call it?
Exactly that.
About what's just and unjust?
Yes.
So won't the man who does this by craft make the same thing appear just to the same people at one time, and unjust whenever he wishes?
Certainly.
And in a speech to the assembly, make the city think the same things good at one time and, at another, just the opposite.
That's so.
And don't we know that the Eleatic palame speaks by such craft? So that the same things appear to his listeners as both like and unlike, both one and many, both at rest and in motion.
Very much so.
So this art of contradiction isn't confined only to the courts and public assemblies. It applies, it seems, to everything that's said. It's one single craft, if it exists at all, by which someone will be able to make everything resemble everything else. Among the things that admit of such resemblance and can be compared, and to bring into the light anyone else who makes such resemblances but conceals it.
What exactly do you mean by that?
I think it will become clear if we look at it this way. Is deception more likely to occur among things that differ a great deal, or things that differ only a little?
Among things that differ only a little.
And moving step by step, in small shifts, you'll get to the opposite of where you started without being noticed, more easily than if you move in one big leap.
How could it be otherwise?
Then anyone who intends to deceive someone else, while not being deceived himself, needs to know precisely the resemblances and differences among the things that exist.
Yes, that's necessary.
But will he really be capable of that, not knowing the truth about each thing, distinguishing the small and large resemblance of what he doesn't know among other things he also doesn't know?
Impossible.
So it's clear that for those who hold opinions at odds with the facts and are deceived, this condition has crept in through certain resemblances.
That's certainly how it happens.
Is there any way, then, that someone will become skilled at shifting people's minds bit by bit through resemblances, leading them each time away from what's true toward its opposite, or himself escaping this, without having first come to know what each of the things that exist actually is.
Never.
So the man who doesn't know the truth, my friend, but has only hunted down opinions, will produce, it seems, some ridiculous and craftless version of the art of speaking.
That's likely.
Would you like us, then, to look in the speech of Lijah's that you're carrying, and in the ones we ourselves spoke, for some example of what we're calling craftless and what's genuinely crafted?
Yes, more than anything, since, as it is, we're speaking rather bare, without enough examples in hand.
And in fact, by some good luck, it seems, the two speeches that were given do contain an example of just how someone who knows the truth might lead his listeners along, playfully, through his words. And I myself, Phaedrus, put this down to the local gods. Perhaps even the prophets of the muses, the singers over our heads, have breathed this gift into us. For I certainly have no share myself in any craft of speaking.
Let it be as you say, just show me what you mean.
Come now, read me the beginning of Lijah's speech.
You know my situation, and you've heard how I think it will benefit us if this happens. I ask not to be denied what I'm requesting simply because I don't happen to be in love with you. Lovers change their minds once.
Stop there. Now we should say where exactly this man goes wrong and makes his speech craftless right.
Yes.
Then isn't this much obvious to everyone? That on some matters of this kind we're of one mind, and on others we're at war with each other.
I think I follow what you mean, but say it more plainly.
When someone says the word iron or silver, don't we all think of the same thing?
Certainly.
But what about when someone says just or good? Don't we scatter in different directions and disagree with each other, and even with ourselves?
Very much so.
So on some things we're in tune, and on others not.
That's right.
Then in which of the two are we more easily deceived, and in which does rhetoric have greater power?
Clearly in the matters where we wander.
So anyone who means to take up the art of rhetoric must first have marked out these two kinds systematically and grasped some defining feature of each, the kind in which the multitude is bound to wander and the kind in which it isn't.
That would certainly be a fine thing to have understood, Socrates, whoever grasps it.
And next, I think, when faced with a particular case, he mustn't miss it but must sharply perceive which of the two kinds whatever he's about to speak of belongs to.
Of course.
Well then, shall we say that love belongs among the disputed matters, or the undisputed ones?
Among the disputed, surely. Or do you think you'd have been free to say what you just said about it, that it's harmful to the beloved and to the lover, and then turn around and say it's actually the greatest of goods?
Very well put. But tell me this too, because, what with my being possessed, I don't quite remember, did I define love at the start of my speech?
Yes, by Zeus, most emphatically.
My, how much more skilled at speaking you make the nymphs of Aeacus and Pan the son of Hermes out to be than Lijah's son of Cephalus. Or am I wrong? And Lijah's too, at the start of his speech on love, forced us to suppose love was some one definite thing. Whatever he wanted it to be, and then, having settled on that, worked out the whole rest of his speech accordingly. Shall we read his opening again?
If you like, though what you're looking for isn't there.
Read it so I can hear it from him directly.
You know how things stand with me, and you've heard how I think it would benefit us if this came about. I claim I shouldn't be denied what I'm asking for simply because I don't happen to be in love with you. For men who are in love regret the favors they've done once their desire has run its course.
Well, he certainly seems far from doing what we're after. He doesn't even swim from the beginning but from the end on his back, working backward through the speech, starting from the point where a lover, already finished with the affair, would be addressing his boy. Or did I say nothing, Phaedrus, dear heart?
Well, Socrates, it is at least an ending, what he's making his speech about.
And the rest? Don't the parts of the speech seem tossed together at random? Does the second point seem to need to come second by some necessity, or any of the other things said? To me, though I know nothing about it, it seemed that the writer said whatever came to him next without much shame. But do you know of some rule of composition by which he set these points down one after another in this order?
You flatter me, thinking I'm capable of seeing through his work that precisely.
But this much, I think, you would grant, that every speech ought to be put together like a living creature, with a body of its own, so that it's neither headless nor footless, but has a middle and extremities, composed so as to fit each other and the whole.
How could it be otherwise?
Consider, then, whether your friend's speech is like that or not, and you'll find it no different from the epitaph some say is inscribed for Midas the Phrygian.
Which one is that, and what's peculiar about it?
It goes like this. A bronze maiden am I, and I lie upon Midas's tomb. As long as water flows and tall trees grow green, remaining right here on this much-wept grave, I will announce to passers-by that Midas lies buried here. You notice, I imagine, that it makes no difference which line is said first or last.
You're mocking our speech, Socrates.
Well then, so you won't be annoyed, let's leave that one aside, though I think it holds plenty of examples one could profitably look to, if one tried not to imitate them too closely, and let's turn to the other speeches. There was something in them, I think, worth noticing for anyone who wants to study speeches.
What exactly do you mean?
The two were opposites, in a way. One argued that favor should be granted to the lover, the other that it should go to the one who isn't in love.
And very manfully, too.
I thought you'd say the true word madly. That's exactly what I was after. We said, didn't we, that love is a kind of madness.
Yes.
And there are two kinds of madness, one arising from human sickness, the other from a divine disruption of our ordinary habits.
Quite so.
And of the divine kind, we distinguished four parts belonging to four gods, prophetic inspiration from Apollo, ritual madness from Dionysus, poetic madness from the Muses, and a fourth from Aphrodite and love. And we said this erotic madness was the best of all. And somehow, likening the experience of love to something, perhaps touching on some truth, though perhaps carried off in another direction too, we mixed together a speech not altogether unpersuasive, and offered up a kind of mythic hymn, in measured and reverent terms, to our mutual master, love, guardian of beautiful boys, Phaedrus.
And it was no unpleasant thing for me to hear, either.
Then let's take this point up right away, how the speech managed to pass from blame to praise.
What exactly do you mean by that?
To me it looks as if the rest was really said in play, but some of what was said by chance touches on two forms, and if one could grasp their power by art, that wouldn't be without charm.
Which forms do you mean?
The ability to take in at a single view and bring under one form, things that are scattered in many places, so that by defining each thing one can make clear whatever one wishes to teach about at any given time. Just as, a moment ago, in speaking of love, whether well or badly said, our speech was at least able to say something clear and consistent with itself because of this.
And what is the other form you mean, Socrates?
The ability, again, to cut things up by forms, along their natural joints, and not to try to break any part in the manner of a bad butcher, but rather, just as our two speeches took, in common, one single form for the mindless side of the soul, and just as out of one body, a pair of limbs naturally grow that share a name, some called left, some called right, So too are two speeches treated derangement as one form naturally present in us. One speech, cutting off the portion on the left, went on cutting it further until it found within it a kind of love rightly called left-handed, and denounced it, quite justly, while the other led us into the region on the right side of madness, and discovering a love that shares its name with the first but is in fact divine, held it out and praised it as the cause of the greatest goods for us.
Very true.
Now I myself, Phaedrus, am a lover of these divisions and collections, so that I may be able to speak and to think. And if I judge anyone else capable of seeing what is naturally one and many, that man I pursue, following in his footsteps as if he were a god. And whether those who can do this are rightly called by this name or not, God knows. But up to now I've been calling them dialecticians. Now tell me what one ought to call what you've learned from Lysias and me. Or is this that very thing, the art of speeches, which Thrasymachus and the rest used to become clever speakers themselves, and to make others so, provided they're willing to bring gifts as to kings?
Kingly men, certainly, but hardly knowledgeable about what you're asking. But this form you seem to me right to call dialectic, the rhetorical form, though, still seems to escape us.
What do you mean? Surely there could be something fine that, though set apart from these, is still grasped by art. At any rate, neither of us should dismiss it without honor. We should say what indeed remains of rhetoric.
Oh, plenty remains, Socrates, at least in what's written in the handbooks on the art of speaking.
And you're right to remind me. First, I believe there's the preamble, how it should be spoken at the beginning of a speech. That's what you mean, isn't it, these fine points of the art?
Yes.
Second, the narration and testimony to back it up. Third, proofs. Fourth, probabilities. And then confirmation and further confirmation, I believe, is what the best word craftsman of Byzantium calls them.
You mean the worthy Theodorus?
Of course. And refutation and counter-refutation, how they should be handled in accusation and defense. And shall we not bring in the excellent evenness of Paros, who first discovered indirect suggestion and indirect praise? Some say he also composes indirect blame in verse, as an aid to memory, for he's a clever man. Shall we let Tisias and Gorgias sleep, who saw that probabilities deserve more honor than truths, who make small things appear great and great things small by the force of language, who present new things in an old style and old things in a new one, and who invented both compression of speech and boundless length on any subject. Prodicus laughed once when he heard me say this, and claimed he alone had discovered what speeches require in the way of art, that they should be neither long nor short, but of moderate length.
Very wise indeed, Prodicus.
And shall we not mention Hippias? I think the stranger from Elis would agree with him.
Why wouldn't he?
And how shall we describe Polus's verbal museum, his doubling of words, his maxims, his figures of speech, and the vocabulary Licymnius gave him as a gift for crafting fine phrasing?
But weren't there also things of Protagoras's kind, Socrates, of that sort?
A certain correctness of diction, my boy, and many other fine things. As for speeches that drag old age and poverty along to stir pity, the strength of the Chalcedonian seems to me to have mastered that art with skill. The man has also proved terribly able to rouse many people to anger at once, and then, when they're angered, to charm them back with incantations, as he used to say, and he's most capable, too, at both leveling slanders and clearing them away. As for the conclusion of speeches, everyone seems to have agreed on it in common, though some call it recapitulation, and others give it some other name.
You mean summing up each point at the end, to remind the hearers of what's been said?
That's what I mean. And anything else you can add about the art of speeches?
Only small things, not worth mentioning.
Let's leave the small stuff aside, then, and look at this larger question in full daylight. What power does this art actually have, and when does it have it?
A very considerable power, Socrates, at least in gatherings of the crowd.
It does have that. But look here, my good man, see whether the fabric of their claim seems as full of holes to you as it does to me.
Just show me.
Tell me this. Suppose someone went up to your friend Eryximachus, or to his father Acumenus, and said, I know how to apply certain things to bodies that will heat them or cool them, as I please, and make them vomit if I decide to, or purge them from below, and any number of other things like that. And because I know these things, I claim to be a doctor, and to be able to make anyone else a doctor too, by handing on this knowledge of mine. What do you suppose they'd say on hearing that?
What else but ask whether he also knows who to do each of these things to, and when, and how far to go?
And if he said, not at all, I expect that whoever learns these things from me will be able to do what you're asking on his own.
I imagine they'd say the man is out of his mind. He's heard something from a book somewhere, or stumbled on some drug recipes, and thinks he's become a doctor when he understands nothing of the art.
And what if someone went up to Sophocles and Euripides and said he knows how to compose enormously long speeches on a trifling subject and very short ones on a great subject, pitiful when he wants, and on the other hand, terrifying and threatening, and so on, and thinks that in teaching this he's handing on the composition of tragedy?
They too, I think, Socrates, would laugh at anyone who imagined tragedy was anything other than the fitting arrangement of these elements with each other and with the whole.
But I don't think they'd scold him crudely. Rather, the way a musician, coming across a man who thinks he understands harmony because he happens to know how to produce the highest and lowest possible notes on a string, wouldn't say harshly, "You wretch, you're out of your mind." But being a musician would say more gently, "My good fellow, it's true that anyone who's going to understand harmony must know these things too, but someone in your position need not understand the first thing about harmony itself. What you know are the necessary preliminaries to harmony, not harmony itself."
Quite right.
And in just the same way Sophocles would tell anyone showing off to them that what he knows are the preliminaries to tragedy, not tragedy itself. And Acumenus would say the preliminaries to medicine, not medicine itself.
Absolutely.
And what about honey-voiced Adrastus, or Pericles for that matter, if they heard the fine techniques we were just going through, the compressed styles and the vivid imagery styles, and all the rest we said needed examining in full daylight? Do you think they'd react the way you and I would, and out of sheer crudeness, blurt out some uneducated remark against the people who have written these things down and teach them as the art of rhetoric? Or, being wiser than we are, would they rebuke us instead, saying, Phaedrus and Socrates, you shouldn't be so harsh. You should make allowances. If some people, not knowing how to conduct a discussion, have proven unable to define what rhetoric actually is, and as a result of this deficiency, possessing only the necessary preliminaries to the art, they've imagined they've discovered rhetoric itself, and in teaching these preliminaries to others they believe they've taught them rhetoric completely, and that the real work, speaking persuasively about each particular case and assembling the whole into a unified composition, is nothing at all, something their students must supply for themselves in their speeches.
Well, Socrates, it does seem likely that this is more or less what the art these men teach and write about as rhetoric amounts to, and I think what you say is true. But how, and from where, could one actually acquire the art of the true rhetorician, the truly persuasive speaker?
As for having the capacity to become a complete competitor in this, Phaedrus, it's likely, indeed probably necessary, that it works the same way as in everything else. If you have a natural aptitude for rhetoric, you'll become a distinguished speaker once you add knowledge and practice. Whatever of these you lack, In that respect, you'll fall short. But so far as there's an art to it, the method doesn't seem to me to lie in the direction Lysias and Thrasymachus are going.
Then which direction does it lie in?
It's likely, my good man, that Pericles became the most accomplished of all in rhetoric, and for good reason.
Why is that?
All the great arts require, in addition, a good deal of talk and speculation about nature at large. This loftiness of mind and this thoroughgoing effectiveness seem to come from somewhere in that direction. This is exactly what Pericles acquired on top of his natural gifts. Falling in, I think, with Anaxagoras, who was a man of just that sort, and getting his fill of speculation about the heavens, and arriving at the nature of mind and intelligence, the very things Anaxagoras talked about at such length, he drew from that source whatever was relevant to the art of speaking.
What do you mean by that?
The same approach applies to medicine as to rhetoric.
How so?
In both, one must analyze a nature, the nature of the body in the one case, the nature of the soul in the other, if you're going to proceed not merely by knack and experience but by genuine art, supplying health and strength to the body by means of medicines and regimen, and supplying the soul, by means of arguments and lawful practices, with whatever conviction and virtue you want to instill.
That's likely, Socrates.
Then do you think it's possible to understand the nature of the soul adequately, without understanding the nature of the whole?
If we're to trust Hippocrates, of the school of Asclepius, not even the body can be understood apart from that method.
He's right to say so, my friend. Still, one should examine what the argument itself says and see whether it agrees with Hippocrates.
I agree.
Then consider what it is that Hippocrates and true reasoning actually say about nature. Isn't this how one must think about the nature of anything at all? First, is the thing about which we intend to become skilled ourselves and capable of making others skilled, simple or complex? Then, if it's simple, we must examine its power, what it is naturally suited to act upon and how, or what it's suited to be acted upon by and by what. And if it has several forms, we must enumerate them, and then, as with the simple case, see for each one what it naturally does and to what, or what it naturally undergoes and from what.
That does seem likely, Socrates.
At any rate, any method that skips this would resemble the progress of a blind man. But surely one who pursues any subject by art should not be compared to someone blind or deaf. Clearly, anyone who teaches speech-making as an art will show with precision the essential nature of that to which he means to apply his speeches. And this, presumably, will be the soul.
Of course.
So all his effort is directed entirely at this. He's trying to produce conviction in the soul. Isn't that right?
Yes.
Clearly, then, Thrasymachus, or anyone else who seriously teaches an art of rhetoric, will first describe and depict the soul with total precision, showing whether it is by nature one and uniform, or, like the shape of the body, takes many forms, for this is what we mean by demonstrating its nature.
Absolutely.
And second, what it naturally does to something, or what it undergoes from something.
Of course.
Third, having classified the kinds of speeches and the kinds of soul, and their various conditions, he'll go through all the causes, fitting each type to each, and teaching which kind of soul is necessarily persuaded by which kind of speech, and for what reason, why this one is convinced and that one resists.
That would certainly be the ideal way to have it, it seems.
Indeed, my friend, nothing demonstrated or spoken in any other way on this or any other subject will ever be spoken or written with genuine art. But the writers you've been listening to, the current crop, are cunning, and they conceal the fact that they know the soul extremely well. So until they speak and write in this manner, let's not believe that they write with art.
What manner is that?
The exact words are not easy to produce, but I'm willing to say how one must write if it's to be as scientific as possible.
Go on, then.
Since the power of speech is in fact a leading of the soul, anyone who intends to become a rhetorician must know how many kinds of soul there are. There are so many, of such and such kinds, which is why some people turn out one way and others another. And once these have been distinguished in this way, there are, correspondingly, so many kinds of speeches, each of a certain sort. People of one type are easily persuaded toward certain conclusions by speeches of a certain sort, for a certain reason, while people of another type are hard to persuade for other reasons. One must grasp all this adequately, and then observe these types actually at work in real situations and being put into practice, and be able to follow them with sharp perception. Otherwise, nothing more is gained than what he heard back when he was merely being lectured on the theory. And when he's able to say adequately what sort of person is persuaded by what sort of argument, and, recognizing someone present, can point out to himself, this is that very type, that very nature, we talked about then, now actually here before me, to whom I must apply these particular arguments in this particular way to produce that particular conviction. Once he has all this, and adds to it a sense of the right moments for speaking and for holding back, and knows when compression is called for and when appeals to pity, when exaggeration for effect, and the right and wrong occasions for each of the styles he's learned, then, and only then, has the art been brought to full and complete perfection and not before. But if anyone falls short in any of this, whether in speaking, teaching, or writing, and yet claims to be speaking by art, the one who refuses to believe him has the better of it. Well then, our writer might say, is that how it seems to you, Phaedrus and Socrates? Should the art of speaking not be accepted in some other way?
There's no other way it could be, Socrates, though it appears to be no small undertaking.
True, and that's exactly why one must turn every argument over, upside down in every which way, and examine whether some easier and shorter road toward it appears anywhere, so as not to go the long, rough way for nothing when a short, smooth one is available. And if you have any help to offer from something you've heard from Lysias or anyone else, try to recall it and tell me.
For the sake of trying, I could, but not as things stand right now.
Then would you like me to tell you an argument I've heard from some people concerned with these matters?
Of course.
There's a saying, Phaedrus, that it's only fair to speak up even for the wolf.
Then you do just that.
Well, they say there's no need to make such a solemn business of it, or take such a long way round from on high, since, as we said at the very start of this discussion, the man who intends to be an adequate rhetorician has no need whatsoever to share in the truth about what's just or good, or about people who are so by nature or upbringing. In the courts, they say, nobody cares in the least about the truth of any of this, only about what's persuasive. And that is the plausible, which is what the man who intends to speak by art must attend to. Indeed, sometimes one shouldn't even mention the actual facts, if they happen not to be plausible, but only the plausible version, whether prosecuting or defending. And whatever one says, one must pursue the plausible and let the truth go hang. Since doing this consistently, throughout the whole speech, is what secures the entire art.
Socrates, you've gone right through the very things that the professionals in speechwriting claim as their own. It reminded me that we touched on this briefly before, and yet the experts in the field think it's an enormous matter.
But surely you've walked through Tisias himself with great care. Then let Tisias tell us this too. Does the probable mean anything other than what the majority happens to believe?
What else could it mean?
And it was this clever and technical discovery, it seems, that led him to write. If a weak but brave man beats up a strong but cowardly one, robs him of his cloak or something else, and is hauled into court, neither party should tell the truth. The coward shouldn't admit he was beaten up by the brave man alone, but should argue that there were two of them, while the brave man should counter that only the two of them were present and fall back on the line. How could a man like me have attacked a man like him? The coward, of course, won't confess his own cowardice, but in trying to invent some other lie, he'll probably hand his opponent an opening to catch him out. And all the other cases that go by the name of technique are, I imagine, of just this sort. Isn't that so, Phaedrus?
Certainly.
Well, Tisias, or whoever else it really is, and whatever name he likes to go by, seems to have hit upon a remarkably well-hidden art. Still, my friend, should we say something to him, or not?
Say what?
This, Tisias, long before you came along, we ourselves were saying that this so-called probability gets its hold on the crowd through its resemblance to truth. And we just went through the point that the person who knows the truth is in every case the one best equipped to find the resemblances. So if you have something else to say about the art of speaking, we'd be glad to hear it. But if not, we'll stick with what we just worked out, that unless someone can enumerate the types of people who will be listening, divide existing things according to their forms, and grasp each particular thing under a single unifying idea, he will never be skilled in speech to the degree a human being can be. And he will never acquire this without a great deal of hard work, work that the sensible man should undertake not for the sake of speaking and acting before other men, but so that he may be able to say what is pleasing to the gods and act in every way as far as he can, so as to please them. For it isn't the case, Tisias, as those wiser than we are say, that a sensible man should practice his craft to please his fellow slaves except incidentally, but rather to please masters who are good and born of good stock. So don't be surprised if the road is long. It must be traveled for great ends, not for the ones you have in mind. Still, the argument tells us this destination will be reached if one is willing, and that these greater results will follow from those very things.
What you say strikes me as altogether splendid, Socrates, assuming someone is capable of it.
But then again, even to attempt fine things is itself fine, whatever one happens to suffer in the attempt.
Quite so.
Well then, that should be enough on the subject of skill, and lack of skill in speeches.
Certainly.
What remains is the question of propriety and impropriety in writing, under what conditions it turns out well, and under what conditions poorly. Isn't that right?
Yes.
Do you know, then, how you might best please a god in what you do or say about speeches?
Not at all, do you?
I can tell you what I've heard from the men of old, though only they themselves know the truth of it. But if we could discover the truth ourselves, would we still care at all about human opinions?
That's a silly question. Just tell me what you say you've heard.
Well, I heard that at Naucrates in Egypt there lived one of the ancient gods of that region, the one whose sacred bird they call the ibis, and the name of this god was Theuth. He was the first to discover number and calculation, geometry and astronomy, and besides these, draughts and dice, and above all, writing. Now the king of all Egypt at that time was Thamus, who ruled from the great city in the upper region that the Greeks call Egyptian Thebes, and they call the god himself Ammon. Theuth came to him and displayed his arts, saying they ought to be passed on to the rest of the Egyptians. Thamus asked what use each one had, and as Theuth explained them, he judged some well-spoken and others not, criticizing this and praising that. Thamus is said to have had a great deal to say to Theuth about each art, both for and against, too much to go through here. But when they came to writing, Theuth said, "This branch of learning, O king, will make the Egyptians wiser and will improve their memory, for I have discovered a remedy for both memory and wisdom."